And Carla Kilbride, I'm wondering, you mentioned that this kind of sledgehammer approach is not just at the EOC, but throughout the federal government in the last few weeks. It reminds me that Mussolini, the founder of modern fascism, declared that fascism was, in essence, he called it corporatism, a merger of state and corporate power. And we're seeing this merger occurring right here now as more and more billionaires and business people are taking over the functions of government. I'm wondering your sense of what this means to the view of the state as a sort of a mediator of the conflicts within society, now to have this government so rapidly taken over by business people.
I am concerned about not only the many actions that the president has taken to exceed his powers under the Constitution, but also the influence of private, unelected representatives of corporations, like Elon Musk, most notably through his role with this shadowy Department of Government Efficiency, which is involved in lots of different agencies. In my new role after leaving the EEOC, I've moved on to Public Citizen, which recently filed suit against the Treasury Department because, at the orders of the Department of Government Efficiency, lots of private information of federal workers, of retirees, of anyone who does business and has financial information stored with the Treasury Department is now in the hands and has access has been given over to unknown and unaccountable, individuals who are affiliated with Elon Musk, who are affiliated with DOGE, which is not a government department, and the individuals, working with Mr. Musk have not gone through the vetting that individuals would normally have to go through in order to have access to that sensitive private information. And so Public Citizen filed suit to seek an injunction, to seek a stop to this turnover of private information, which there are should be government safeguards to protect. But in this unprecedented sort of mixture of private and public authority through involving oligarchs at the highest levels of our government who are unelected, that needs to be stopped. And we hope that the courts will step in to put an end to this unprecedented mixture of private and public power and abuse of executive authority.
Carla Kilbride, before we end, can you describe what happened last week when you and two EEOC commissioners were fired? What happened? What time was it?
So I received the email at around 10:30 p.m. telling me that, again, citing this sort of unbounded authority that the president has to have people that agree with him ideologically serving in his administration, that my services were no longer required. And the email also referred to, again, this concept of gender ideology, this idea that the president wanted to be able to enforce the sex binary, even though, as I mentioned, that's contrary to Supreme Court precedent. And there was also a reference in the email to diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, has just become sort of a boogeyman and a concept that is being used to tar all sorts of efforts, including the efforts of the EEOC to enforce the civil rights laws, which is what I was doing as general counsel, was overseeing litigation to enforce civil rights laws that have been on the books for 30, in some cases, 60 years.
Carla Kilbride, want to thank you for being with us. Just fired by Trump as general counsel of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Considering an online pharmacy? Explore BeSafeRx to find useful information and resources to help you purchase medicines safely online. A safe online pharmacy requires a doctor's prescription, has an address in the United States, has a licensed pharmacist, and is licensed by a state pharmacy board. It's best to stay away from online pharmacies that don't meet these criteria. Discover more helpful tips and resources at BeSafeRx. Go to fda.gov/BeSafeRx.
At the turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild, cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go, riding along in my
WRCT Pittsburgh, music for people on the go.
I sent you to tell her the way I feel. So I told her softly and sincere, and she leaned and whispered in my ear.
The One World Radio program, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio, Hofstra University in Hempstead, New York. Broadcasting from the Bush Radio Salt River Studios in Cape Town is host me, Lydia Mahwanana. Broadcasting from WRHU Studios in Hempstead, New York, are your hosts, Cody Millar and Andy Gladding. We welcome you to join us for the next hour as we celebrate the power of community radio, diversity, music, language, and culture. The world is a big place, but using the power of radio, we're bringing it right to your door. Now, Bush Radio and WRHU welcome you to the one world of community radio.
Must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you.
WRHU Hempstead, 88.7, 89.5 Bush Radio Cape Town, 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh. You're listening to the One World Radio Show. I'm your host, Cody Millar, joined with me by Ricky Hubert. Thank you so much for joining. Ricky, how are you doing?
I'm very well, Cody. How are you?
Just trying to survive this cold. I mean, we have record cold fronts right now, and
in the Northeast, yeah.
Yeah, it's -8.
I don't think the Bush audience can relate so much to that, but that's okay. We're
very fortunate. Hopefully it does not ever get that cold in Cape Town.
No, that's when you know we have a problem. That's when you know that we have a problem. Yes.
Yeah. I have a work trip to Lexington, Kentucky this coming week.
You travel everywhere.
Something like that. But I was like, you know, it'll be nice heading to the South, you know, escape some of the cold. And it's looking like it's going to be colder than Pittsburgh.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so strange. But you travel everywhere. You go to Kentucky. You're going down to New Orleans down in the spring, right, in May?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. But bring us back a souvenir.
I'll try, Ricky. But we are joined by the wonderful Liz Burke, PR professional, freelance reporter, and professor here at Hofstra University.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, Cody addressed in the intro that you are a freelance journalist, a PR professional, and now you're a professor. What we ask about people who go into any form of profession is, what really got you interested? At an early age, did you know that you wanted to go into the business of storytelling, as they call it? What really started that for you?
It did start at a young age when I was probably 5, 6 years old, 7 years old. When I was young, I watched journalist Jessica Savage, news anchoring and reporting for NBC. And I wished I could report on television one day. In addition, my father worked in layout for Newsweek magazine, and I always admired his work and enjoyed listening to his stories about his job and the news. So at a very young age, I was very interested in current events. And as I grew, I really became a news junkie. And later on in life, I decided that I wanted to switch gears a little bit and go into teaching. So my career really went full circle. So for my bachelor's degree, I earned a degree in teaching from Ithaca College. And I taught for a few years, but that news aspect of working was still in the back of my mind. So I decided to go back to school, and I earned my master's degree in communication arts from the New York Institute of Technology. And at the time, the college aired a student TV news program called Long Island News Tonight. And that's where I got my start in television. At Long Island News Tonight, they sent us out in the field right away. I got a couple of days of training, and then I was reporting on my own stories. I learned how to write news, interview subjects, do reporter stand-ups, compose a balanced news story. Each student would report once a week, and it was such a great feeling to see your work on air after all those efforts in the field. So I really got a great start at that school. And like I said, my career has gone full circle. Now I'm able to incorporate my teaching skills that I acquired in my undergraduate degree, and I'm able to teach in the classroom what I do in the field. So I feel very lucky to have this opportunity in my career.
Now we're going to backtrack a little bit, if you don't mind, because you gave us a lot of information there. So you were saying you were very young, you became a news junkie, you were obsessed with the business. So what I really wanted to ask you about that was, you went to school in high school. Did you do any journalism activities, things of that nature?
I did a little bit. I was very interested in any classes that involved writing, English. I was also interested in a business class that also incorporated business reporting. So I had a little bit of a feel for it in high school, but I didn't write for the school paper per se.
Oh.
It was always in the back of my mind. It was always something that I wanted to do. And honestly, I felt as though it was an unrealistic career for me, and teaching was a little bit safer.
Is that why you made the choice that you made to go into to teaching? You were a Spanish teacher, correct?
Yes, I taught Spanish. I taught at the middle school level. I taught at the high school level. I was a leave replacement teacher, a substitute teacher. And I just decided if I wanted to actually dive into this journalism career, I have to do it now and earn my master's degree. And at the time, I didn't even realize that later on in life, I would need that master's degree as a requirement to become a professor. So it really worked out well for me.
So what would you say was that moment in your teaching career? It's very simple. There used to be a show on the air, Mike and Molly, many years ago. It was a Melissa McCarthy sitcom. And she was a teacher, but her dream was always to be a writer. And so in very comic fashion for the show, they have her jump out the window, pratfall style, tell the kids, follow your dreams, and she quits the job. I assume that's not how it happened for you, deciding that you wanted to go pursue journalism. What was the moment where it really instilled in you, like, I have to do this, there's no way I can't?
I actually told myself that I have more confidence in this than I thought. You know, I feel that in life, when you become an adult, as you grow older, you gain more confidence. It's different for every individual, but I felt as though when I was teaching, I gained confidence in that type of profession, and I would talk to myself and give myself inspiration and let myself know that, you know what, maybe I could do this. And what's the worst thing that can happen? I don't make it in TV. I don't make it in news. Okay, I could always fall back on television. And my parents were very involved in that as well, always instilling confidence in me and giving me encouragement. So I credit a lot to my parents who really helped me along the way in making those decisions.
Now, Liz, you've been working in the New York news market for, you know, such a long time. I'm curious, how would you kind of describe the New York market for our listeners? What is it like to report in New York?
It can be chaotic, exciting, intense. We know that the news cycle is ever-changing. I, as mentioned, work at News 12 Long Island, which is a subsidiary under Altice USA, and I work out of the Bethpage Long Island studio, mostly covering Long Island stories. But we have a lot of connections also to New York City in terms of our coverage. So overall, what I'm doing is I'm conducting field reporting as an on-camera journalist, interviewing public officials, subject matter experts, the public, and I'm delivering live and taped general assignment news reports. What I have noticed in recent years is, in some cases when I'm reporting in the field, we have viewers out there who love us. They see our News 12 Thunderbolt 12 car drive by. They want to talk to us. They want to engage with us. Sometimes we don't get that kind of reception. There can be some division in terms of feelings and opinions on politics, and that can translate into what we see in the field. So, you know, we need to be careful in how we present ourselves and, you know, how we're talking to people and how we're receiving information and having these conversations in the field. Having said that, I think there's been a broadening in the types of topics that we can cover in the field. And I am given more of an opportunity to go to many neighborhoods and get diverse perspectives and cover topics that maybe I wouldn't have covered years ago. So there's a wide range of subject matter that we're able to cover. And now we're really gaining a lot of exposure on social media. And what's great about that is that I can hear from the audience in real time, in the comment section, in my DMs. What does the audience want to hear about? What topics do they want us to cover? If I'm going out on a story, I can ask my online audience, what question do you want me to ask? So it's really flipped the script, no pun intended, in terms of how the audience engages with us, mostly in a positive manner.
That's so cool. And I know New York is considered the media capital of the world, home to our largest national networks. So to hear this about local news, I feel like it's just so much more personable. You know, you're able to actually get that interaction with the audience and connect to members of your own community on that much of a deeper level.
And I think that really helps our output of news, because now we have our viewers, our online users involved in storytelling. Yes, we are checking our facts and we're making sure that we have everything covered in terms of the foundation of our stories. But to get those diverse perspectives, and there are so many times when I post a story online and someone DMs me and says, oh, there's another angle here that you can explore. And then I dive deeper into that angle. And then at the next editorial meeting, I am pitching that story. So to really hear from these neighborhoods and to hear from these local residents has helped our local news organization. And I would say from what I have read and researched, I would say that social media has a great impact on other news organizations as well, even the New York City organizations.
Now, there's been a lot of discussions about how media is dying and the consolidation of media is a main role. Do you feel like that's true, or do you feel like there's a expansion in media consumption?
In the state of local journalism?
Yes.
Well, anecdotally, I will say that I believe one of the reasons people turn to local news is because it is, generally speaking, objective reporting. I think there's been some level of exhaustion when it comes to some of the cable channels where viewers are watching news, consuming news in a news bubble, and they're only hearing one side of the story. So I hear from people a lot that it's so refreshing to tune into local news and just receive neutral reporting. Tell me the facts, what's going on in my area, how can I stay informed, those types of things. Now, there are a lot of statistics on this. I've done plenty of research on it. According to the Pew Research Center, a growing number of people prefer to get local news online, and less are getting news on TV or in print. And I see this with your audience, with your demographic, with the younger demographic. The number of adults in the U.S. who are paying close attention to local news has dropped in some cases, but many still see value in local news and local journalism. I think the challenge, one of the main challenges that news organizations have, is that they really need to fully embrace digital. Because every semester, I ask my students at Hofstra University, how many of you watch TV? Hardly any student raises their hand, and they tell me that their parents, their guardians, are the ones watching TV. So local news and regional news, national news, really needs to embrace digital. You know, we hear a lot about news deserts and the fall of print journalism, but I look at it as a positive way. Let's, you know, turn that print journalism into online journalism. Okay, so I'm not reading journalism, I'm not reading news stories in a paper, but I'm reading it online. And so are my colleagues, and so are my family, friends, and my students. We're all getting our news online. So just sort of shift that mindset and consume that news online through social media. I think there needs to be a big push towards social media journalism. A lot of emphasis has been on adding news to streaming services, which I am in agreement with, but I think that same emphasis should be on social media journalism. So for example, if a local news organization gets their anchor doing headlines on a streaming service, they should also have that anchor delivering headlines on Instagram, on TikTok. We need to go where the audience is. So I do see plenty of news organizations investing in digital first newsrooms and adapting to the audience's needs. And we need to continue to see more of that.
It's very interesting that you were saying about social media journalism, because I had a friend of mine who's not involved in communications or journalism in any way, shape, or form, texted me the other day and mentioned that there was a news anchor that she was following in Houston, Texas, and she lives up in Lackawaxe in Pennsylvania, obviously two very different worlds, and he live streamed his local news broadcast on TikTok, and so that's how he would gain an audience. So it's very interesting that you brought that up. I want to ask you about the younger demographics and what you were talking about there with social media, because you're obviously a professor now at Hofstra University. How did that come about, first and foremost? We'll kind of get into that, because you were working in the field as a journalist, then you were working in PR, then you went back to journalism. If you really could elaborate about why, because obviously if you're very passionate about journalism, what you've spoke about today, why was it so important for you to keep going back to journalism, and what made you feel so important to teach journalism to this younger generation?
Great questions. So in terms of entering into the PR field, I had been working as, first I started as an intern at News 12 Long Island, and then they gave me some writing opportunities, and then I started doing some behind the scenes work, working on my resume reel, and eventually became an on-camera reporter, which was fantastic. I loved it. I loved telling stories, meeting new people. Amazing. But as most people know, the schedule as a reporter is grueling, and you are away from your family a lot. You're away from your friends a lot, working every weekend, working every holiday. And I did that for about 5 years as an on-camera reporter. And they would also send me to different locations. I would drive to News 12 Westchester and report stories out of that region. I would drive to Connecticut. So it was difficult and challenging at times. And like I said, it really changed my lifestyle and quality of life. And I had heard from some PR friends that you could have a different quality of life if you entered that field. And you could also, in some cases, make more money. You know, especially starting out in news, you're not going to make a lot of money. And it can be a little bit challenging. So I spoke with some PR people, went on a couple of interviews. I wasn't really sure if it was going to go anywhere. And then an agency in New York City took me on for a 6-month tryout and said, you know, you don't have any PR education, you don't have PR experience, and you're coming out of news, which is great, but we're really taking a chance on you. So I worked there for 6 months, and they kept me on, and I stayed there for 5 years. And it was fantastic. I was now on the other side of news. I was pitching stories to news outlets about my PR clients. So it was wonderful to see that other side of news and be able to tell stories that way. I was a spokesperson for certain clients, so public speaking skills were folded in again. I was talking still to public officials, creating client campaigns, and then I started getting into social media and doing social media on behalf of my clients, which was amazing, because then when I returned to journalism, I had some of those social media skills. I'm not saying I'm an expert at social media, but at my age, it was a little bit of a challenge because we didn't grow up with phones in our hands. We didn't grow up with online technology. So it was a lot to learn and a lot to learn fast. So I hope that answers part of your question.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it does. Now, I wanted to ask, I have had you as a professor, so I've heard dribs and drabs of your stories.
Yes.
But I wanted to say, you said you went back to journalism because you missed it so much. What really was, again, the tipping point? You said, I want to do this kind of storytelling now instead of PR, which is very good in its own right.
Yes, yes. And, you know, many times I have students come up to me and they're deciding between working in a PR career or working in a journalism career. And it's such a tough decision to make because a lot of the same skills are used. So I try to give them good advice, but it's a tough conversation sometimes.
And in ways, there is a lot of overlap between those. There is a lot of journalism to PR, I feel like, and a lot of PR to journalism.
Yes, yes. I would say that I really missed the art of storytelling as an individual. So when you're working in PR, you're essentially telling stories for your clients. You're telling stories for other people. And I wanted to be the one to break that news, to be out there in the field, to get involved in the communities, to, you know, put a microphone in someone's face and, you know, just to be part of the story more. And I miss that level of excitement, that intensity. You know, I look at reporting, it's almost like playing a sport. So when I'm done with my shift, I feel like I've actually played a game in the field, because that's what it's like. I mean, you are under the gun, meeting deadlines. You got to get your facts right. You have to perform. You have to do it well. And I think I missed that level of excitement.
Now, we've talked a lot about the positives of news. When we have those hard days, because working in media, inevitably we have those days that you're just struggling to get through it. What is, you know, things that you do to kind of get through that and get back to, you know, the joys of reporting?
Another great question. So because I am living this double career, on the positive end of it, I can bring my fieldwork experience into the classroom. But wearing different hats isn't always easy. A few things that I need to do to just be able to work day to day and perform at an optimum level is, number one, get enough sleep. So I cannot commit myself to too many shifts at News 12 and have that impact my teaching. My students are very important to me. I have a lot of responsibility day to day in the classroom. I spend a lot of time putting my lessons together and researching and trying to meet the needs of students, because at the end of the day, my job is that my students are successful and they are prepared and on the right path to get a job out of Hofstra. And I take that very seriously. So I need to get enough sleep. I don't commit to a lot of shifts at News 12, one or two per week. But there are other things that I do. I plan a lot. I literally plan every following day out, from what I wear, what I eat, travel. It may sound a little bit robotic, but if I don't do this type of planning, I can, you know, fall back on some things. The notes section of my phone is my latest best friend. I keep various lists in my phone to keep everything in order. When I receive emails from students, I try to respond in a very quick manner and stay up to date on my emails. I keep my emails very organized. So I think organization, planning, proper communication. I want to offer my students office hours and meet with them, whether it's Zoom or in person. It doesn't matter to me, because I feel like making those student connections and guiding and helping students along the way, those are very important responsibilities that I have. And then really channeling my mind. So when I'm at News 12, I am channeling my mind. Okay, now I'm in news mode. What are the five W's? Who, what, where, when, why, and how? Who are my subjects? Let me get my videographer. Let's get out in the field. What is my first live hit? Is it 5 a.m.? Okay, we're going to do multiple hits. I just covered a snowstorm on Sunday out on Long Island, which impacted New York and other Northeast areas, and it was a pretty significant snowstorm. So I was on storm coverage, and my shift started at 1:30 in the afternoon, and I was live every hour at the top of the hour. And what you need to do as a news reporter, especially when you're covering storms, is you need to try and make every field report different, every hit, as we call it in the industry, different. Interviewing different people, showing different things. When you're doing snowstorm coverage, a lot of it is show and tell. Okay, here's what we're seeing and hearing, and here's what I can tell you. Those are important things to tell the audience. And of course, now you are dealing with the elements. You are braving these winter elements, which can be very challenging. So as I was doing the storm coverage on Sunday, for every hit, I literally had to change something in my winter gear. I started off with just a jacket, then I had to put the scarf on for the next report, then earmuffs, then a hat, then a hood, gloves. I even had hand warmers in my gloves because it got so cold and windy and snowy. But that involves a lot of effort in the field, live reports, continuous updates, important interviews. And, you know, we let Long Islanders know what we are seeing and hearing and bringing them the most up-to-date details to keep them safe and informed.
You have a dual responsibility to both of your audiences, those in the classroom and those who are watching you on television and engaging on social media. Before we get into more of maybe the social media stuff, because we touched on that earlier, mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you, because what you were saying about time management, you have to work a lot of weekends. We earlier on in the year, back in the fall, we had on a Broadway performer on the show, and she was saying who also now is an educator of theater, of her profession, what she does, kind of like you, a double life kind of thing. And mm-hmm. she was saying, you know, you're working weekends, you're working nights, you're missing things, you have a family. What really led you to go back to teaching at Hofstra? What really inspired you to make that, to have that moment?
Sure. I had an opportunity to reconnect with a professor who currently works at Hofstra. I was attending an event, and he was at the event, and we got to talking, and he said, would you ever think about maybe teaching a class at Hofstra University? I said, I haven't really given it that much thought in recent years. You know, I've been involved in PR, I've been involved in news. And he said, well, we may have an opportunity. Why don't you think about it? And I told him, well, out of college, I did teach for a couple of years, and I loved teaching. I mean, at the age of 11, the one thing that I wanted for my birthday was a chalkboard. And my parents got me a chalkboard. And I would literally, we had a basement at the time. And I had my sister and I invited friends. And I would, at the age of 11, invite them and teach classes. And it sounds so funny because you would think, okay, these neighbors are coming to your home and listening to you. But they would. These kids would come and watch me at the chalkboard. And I would give them lessons and fun lessons. And they would listen to me and follow my instructions. So at a very young age, I really like to teach. I love to help people. And I love to help them and see them grow in what they're doing. So that was really important to me at a very young age as well. So it's been some journey for me in terms of my career. And like I said earlier, I feel very lucky that I'm able to perform and be part of both careers in such a substantial way. But it was really that meeting at an event where I reconnected with this professor who we worked together at News 12 years ago. And so I slept on it for a couple of nights and I thought about it and said, you know what, let me see if I can do this. And they had an opening for a class. It was a graduate class beginning in January of 2019. And I figured, why not? I always like to take risks in my career. Why not? You know, let me just see if I can do this. And I did it and I loved it. And then the next semester they said, oh, can you teach two classes? I said, sure. So then I was teaching two classes. Now I'm teaching three classes. Now I'm advising interns. I'm involved in independent studies, research, et cetera. So it's really worked out well.
Balancing on camera and classroom work, right? What's the biggest difference between addressing a live audience on camera and then coming back and teaching students in the classroom?
Well, in both cases, in terms of similarities, you are performing. For live camera, live journalism, I am performing, essentially. Yes, I am telling the news, but I'm also performing because if I'm telling the news in a very boring way, who is going to listen to me? And then when I'm in the classroom, I feel like I am performing as well. I want to keep these lessons upbeat. I don't want to drag down the class. I want to keep students engaged. I want them working in teams, talking to each other, talking to me, and really keeping that energy level high. One of the main differences is really the goals of what you're doing. So the goals for live journalism, live reporting is keeping the audience informed, keeping them up to date, giving them the facts, giving them the subjects that they want to hear from, answering their questions. The goals in the classroom, as I look at it from my perspective, is helping students in their journey through college and getting them the most prepared and the most qualified to gain a job in the industry of their choice. And in both cases, there's a lot of responsibility that comes with that. And in both cases, both careers, I take it very seriously. So I think the main difference is just the goals of the job can vary because you are dealing with somewhat of different audiences and the objectives for the students are different than the objectives of the audience in terms of news consumption.
And you sound so passionate about the work that you are doing. Like, I'd like to know, how do you keep yourself motivated to continue even excelling in such demanding and varied roles?
Number one, I love to work. And I am so lucky that I can work in these professions that I love so much. So I love to work. That's part of why I think my energy is high. And I feel as though if you pick a profession, now it's varies from individual to individual, depending on your priorities. Some people want to go into finance and make a lot of money. Some people want to go into law, practice law, and defend people. And I get that. But I do feel that if you're in a job that you really enjoy, you're going to put that dedication into it. You are going to put that energy into it. You are not going to dread going to work. I think one of the worst things in a career is dreading going to work. If you can wake up and be excited about going to work and get a lot of satisfaction and gratification in your career, that's going to help you. That's going to help you in your energy, in your delivery, in your motivation, and how hard you work and how much effort you put into that job.
And I'd like to know, like, in your view, right, how has the rise of misinformation and fake news impacted the trust between local journalists and the audience? Because I know here in South Africa, media is not trusted at all.
Excellent question. And I touched on this a little bit earlier. Sometimes when we go into the field, most of our news cars for News 12 are branded. It could say News 12, News 12 Thunderbolt, which we drive around for storms, etc. So people know who we are. And sometimes we get criticism and we will have people yelling out fake news. But meanwhile, I personally believe that our news organization on this local level does not put out fake news. I think that we are very objective. And I think a lot of people turn to us for that neutral reporting that they're not seeing on the cable stations. And I do think that social media, while it has a lot of advantages to it in terms of journalism, we see a lot of misinformation and disinformation. So it makes our jobs harder because now we have to combat that. And we spend a lot of time vetting social media content. And we may have viewers who DM us or write comments and say, oh, we're hearing this, but you're reporting that. And we will investigate and we will give the facts. And that's really what we try to do at News 12. Give the facts, keep our audience informed, and cover the topics that we believe Long Islanders want to hear. But it is a very challenging landscape out there. Between the online content and the social media content. And I don't have answers for it. It's just a matter of staying on top of it, trying to set the record straight, and even being kind to our audiences. When I'm in the field and maybe someone criticizes me or gets a little bit angered or something like that, I just stay calm. Talk to them. You know, sometimes they just want to talk to somebody and I'll talk to them and then we're all of a sudden in a good conversation. So I think connecting with people and trying to just listen to them and not give my opinion because I'm an objective reporter, I want to stay neutral, is one of the ways that we can sort of lower the heat on all of this. But it's a very tough area.
Yes, it is. And what has been the most rewarding moment of your career so far?
Wow. I have many rewarding moments. On the news side, it's, well, I had this recently. I covered a story where a man on Long Island who had no previous heart problems all of a sudden was getting very sick, and it was near Christmas time. And he was rushed to the hospital, and he was having major heart problems. And his family contacted News 12, and he was in need of a heart. So I was assigned to this story, big responsibility here. Now I'm talking to the family. The husband is in the hospital. And we aired this story. And it went viral, in a sense, for Long Island. And we got so much trending on social media, so many calls, people wanting to help. And what happened was his health insurance was not going to cover the heart transplant. Well, guess what? When my story aired and we got all of this exposure, the health insurance changed their minds. I don't know if our one story had the entire impact on that, but it definitely played a role in my opinion. They were able to be covered by the health insurance. He then got on the heart transplant list and he now has a new heart. Just an amazing story. And if it weren't for the local journalism that we did at News 12, maybe this story would have ended up very differently and tragically. So I am so grateful that it turned out well for him. And it, you know, these types of things are just emotional. They get me very emotional because I'm so happy for these people. On the education side, when a student tells me that they have earned an internship or they got a job, or thank you for writing that reference letter, it helped me get this internship or this job or this career, or they contact me years later on LinkedIn and thank you for your mentorship, Professor Burke. I can't even describe what kind of feeling that is. It's just amazing. And I love it. And it really, really helps you realize that you're having an impact on people.
For listeners who want to get involved with journalism or storytelling, what advice would you give them?
My first piece of advice would be learn everything you can on the digital end. Social media reporting, learn the platforms, learn how to edit audio, video, the Adobe tools. Learn as much as you can in the digital landscape, because I find that many of the news directors are looking for that component. And for those who are interested in broadcast journalism, start putting your resume reel together early. That doesn't mean that you're going to be sending it out yet. Start getting your stories done, your news packages, putting them in an organized folder on your computer so that when it's time to put your resume reel together, you have all the content in place. Ask a professor to look at your resume reel. I look at a lot of resume reels. I love to help students with their resume reels and help them enhance them, perfect them before they do the job search. I even tell them, don't send a resume reel out unless I look at it. Also for college students, if you can, go to the Career Center. Even if the Career Center, in your opinion, is not helping you with your industry specifically, they will help you with cover letter writing, resume writing, especially at Hofstra. They will sit with you and do mock job interviews, mock internship interviews, so you can prepare before you do the face-to-face or you do the Zoom. But I really think the piece about digital is important, and anything you can learn about AI. So now I'm hearing that news organizations are using AI for social media. So what they'll do is they'll take a news package, put it into AI, and then that will produce a social media post for their news outlet channels on the socials. I'm not saying that all news organizations are doing this, but I think that's one practice that I'm hearing about more and more. So anything on AI, digital, and getting your portfolio together really early and start thinking about that. Start thinking about outlining what you want to have in your resume reel and getting opinions. Get opinions from your parents. Get opinions on your portfolio from friends, from family, from professors. The more people who look at your content, the more feedback you get, the better position you will be to have a really good portfolio when you start interviewing. And of course, use tools like spell check, Grammarly. That's okay. Use those so you don't have any spelling errors. If you send a cover letter out and there's one typo, they could toss that in the garbage. So you really need to have all of your T's crossed and your I's dotted.
Expanding on that, what advice would you give to community members who want to get into reading, watching, or listening to the news?
Meaning what ways should they find news or, I'm sorry.
Yeah, building the habit of actually looking to local journalism or just, you know, reading the news. So many young people I talk to are like, I'm interested in learning about what's going on in my world, but I don't know how to. And building that habit of media, you know, digestion and literacy.
Oh, that's an interesting question. Thank you. One of the things that I think younger individuals can do is follow the right news sources on their social media channels. So follow news sources that are reputable, that are objective, and follow them on Instagram, on TikTok, and also utilize streaming services that have news content in it. So if you are going on to Fire TV, check out Newsday TV. Check out their anchor giving the headlines. Every morning on Newsday TV, an anchor delivers Long Island headlines. And I watch it every morning just to hear the top news. And of course, I'm watching News 12 as well. But hearing from different perspectives, Newsday, News 12, or whatever your local community is. But really following the news organizations that will help you and make a habit of it so that, let's say in the morning, you can even put it on your calendar if you like, but in the morning, checking the X platform and seeing what people are saying. Also on the X platform, you can, and other platforms as well, you can tailor your social media platform so that all you're seeing are news outlets of the day. And then maybe even talking about it with your friends. Did you hear about Elon Musk today, or, you know, the latest news that's coming across the wire? Engaging with your friends in this kind of conversation, because maybe your friends want to talk about it too.
Now, obviously, this is a program that's a global collaboration. We have Lydia in South Africa. Cody and I are in the U.S. Obviously, you're in the U.S. You've worked as a journalist here for a very long time. The topic of freedom of the press, that looks very different all around the world where Lydia is, where we are. As someone who's been in the journalism business for as long as you have, in local journalism, what does freedom of the press mean to you? How would you define it?
Well, freedom of the press is, of course, very important. It is part of the First Amendment, and it is something that we take very seriously as journalists, and we know that we need to be accountable and responsible for the information that we give. And I do think it's important for journalists to have that freedom because, number one, we need to hold government officials accountable. We are essentially watchdogs in the field to make sure that government is run correctly. We are diving into stories for investigative reporting and uncovering things that maybe are putting people at a disadvantage. So in a way, reporters are helping people. They are helping them stay informed. They are helping them in their communities. They are helping them stay safe. So if we don't have the freedoms to report in the way that we need to, we are limiting the amount of information and the quality of information that viewers need, that residents need in a community. And we see a lot of news deserts now, especially across the country, where local journalism, local newspapers are folding. And that's really unfortunate because a lot of people want to see their local news. Yes, they care about national news. They care about international news. But what is happening in my backyard? So at a local level, regional, national, international, we need to have these freedoms so we can best represent the news, deliver subjects that are experts in certain fields. We want to hear from diverse perspectives, going into communities and giving a voice to the voiceless. That, in my mind, is all under that umbrella of freedom of the press, which is really important for the democracy of our country.
What have, in these last five, six years that you've been teaching at Hofstra, your journalism students, your communication students, what have they taught you about being a better journalist, and how have you applied that to your job?
Well, that's another good question. I feel as though students are teaching me how they are consuming news. And when I started teaching at Hofstra in 2019, it was a little bit different back then. And at that time, I did hear about social media, but not so much social media reporting. And there were students who were watching television. Now, when I ask students in my classes, do you watch television? Maybe one hand is raised and their parents are watching television. So students are teaching me how they are consuming news, where they are consuming news. And guess what? That changes my lessons because now I have to adjust what I am teaching because I need to tailor it for this new audience, for this younger demographic. And I have had situations in some of my classes where students show me something about an app that I've never heard of before or a platform that I've never heard of before. And I love that we can have this back and forth because they can teach me things about digital that I don't know, keeping me young in a sense. So I love that part of it. And it's a really great experience when a professor and a student can work together and see the completion of a project and get that input from students. So I really, really love to hear input from students. I love to hear questions from students. And if they can teach me something, amazing. I will learn from it.
Something I wanted to try before we wrapped up here is, obviously, Professor Burke, you've had a lot of experience covering stories. Lydia's covered stories. Cody's covered stories. And like we were saying, Cody was saying, and you guys were talking before, it can be a very dark world with a lot of the stories that we have to cover. And before we wrap up, I kind of would like each of us to share a story we have covered that made us feel more positive maybe about the world around us. If you would like to start, Professor Burke, the floor is yours.
A positive story. I would say any time that I cover a Habitat for Humanity story, this is an organization that builds homes for people who are in need. So it's a great piece of work when I can see in the field this completion of a home. So what we do when we cover Habitat for Humanity stories is we get video, we shoot B-roll of the house being built, and part of the building is done by the very people who are going to live in that home. So they have a stake in it as well, because they are one of the builders, if you can believe it, which makes it even more amazing. And then we see these families in the home. This is something that was a dream for them. They could never imagine having their own home. Some of them live in small apartments. They live in a basement. A lot of people are living in one home. One family in a dream home that they built in part, and to see that from the beginning to completion is so gratifying, and I'm so happy for these families. And it's such a positive story that we always get a lot of positive reaction from viewers and online users.
A positive story that I've covered? Oh, wow, goodness. I think it was about a year ago. But it's more of something that we normally do here at Bush Radio, where we go, go to organizations for the 16 days of activism, where we speak to the organizations and the victims of abuse, and they share these stories and teach people about abuse and give out their services, where the place is and the kind of services that they provide.
Yeah, there's a story recently did where a township in Pennsylvania, they were plowing the roads for snow, but in doing so was piling all of the snow on the sidewalk, blocking accessibility for folks in wheelchairs or pedestrians or folks trying to bike to school, because believe it or not, people still have to bike and commute to school, even though it's, you know, 5 degrees, negative 4 degrees. And so through kind of this advocacy, we were able to actually get them to start plowing the sidewalks as well and salting early in the morning. So, you know, everyday citizens could, you know, easily get to work or school or whatnot if they're not using the bus or not necessarily using their own cars.
So I think with that, we can say thank you, Professor Elizabeth Burke, for coming on and sharing your stories from the world of journalism, the classroom, and beyond this morning. We really do appreciate you taking time to be with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a joy.
You've been listening to the One World Radio Show on 88.7 WRHU Hempstead, 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh, and 89.5 Bush Radio Cape Town. I'm your host, Cody Millar, joined along with Ricky Hubert, Lydia Marquena. All right, thank you so much.
You've been listening to One World Radio, a collaboration between 89.5 FM Bush Radio, Cape Town, South Africa, and 88.7 FM WRHU Radio Hofstra University, Hempstead, New York. We thank you for joining us and look forward to seeing you next week as we celebrate the power of radio in our one world. Tot ziens, jylle.
To you. I'm talking about all your secret friends over the airwaves. You're on the radio.
You on the radio with WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hi, this is Greg Keeler with Blue Rodeo here, 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Denkst du vielleicht gerade an mich, dann singe ich ein Lied für dich. haben schon fette Beute, liefen Krieg und Waldenmacht. Man hätte das gedacht, dass es einmal so weit kommt. In 99 noch bei uns.
Listening to The Sound of Language on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
Hello, this is Ashley Ross, and welcome to the latest episode of Sound is Not a Language. For this recording, on January 31st, I'm coming to you from the opening of a solo exhibition, Chinua Achebe Behavior, by none other than our very own MFA cohort, Annie Chen. Before I get to the sounds of the opening reception, let's first talk about the charcuterie board. A lot of galleries and institutions don't understand that sometimes an opening reception is made by how good the food and drinks are. I'm being dead serious. And as a grad student, especially an art grad student, this is basically dinner. So I appreciated the attention to detail with the delicious selection of fruits, which included pineapples, melons, grapes, and strawberries. The meats and cheeses were of great quality as well. But let's talk about the most important part of the show, which is Annie's show. You can tell from how intricate some of the pieces are that there is an incredible amount of thought and research and investigation that goes into her practice and specifically the pieces. Also, experiencing her work outside of CMU has me appreciating her approach to her art practice even more. I love how, although her work considers colonization and migration through various methods of travel and experience, she's also considering and challenging the viewer to consider context and the environment. Her work never feels like she just slaps something together and calls it a day. She's constantly questioning, learning, and experimenting. And she takes the time to really understand what she's working with, and it shows. And so I'm super excited that we all got to go and experience Annie's show in person and have a good time and support, you know, building careers specifically within an MFA program. And it's excited to see that somebody already has a solo show in the first year. So enjoy the sounds of an opening reception. I got to interview a few people. Enjoy. Congrats, Annie.
Wow, how do you feel? You.
It looks beautiful.
Thank you very much.
So this is the one you made.
Yeah, I love that one.
Okay.
Yeah, I want to do that.
Yeah.